Today's Wednesday, October 23rd, and we're having Matt with us to talk about conflicts all over the world.
Unfortunately, not dialogue, but conflict. Yeah,
exactly. Matt, let's start with these leaked documents and about the Israeli attack on Iran. What's your take on these documents and what was the concern behind this type of attitude? I don't know who did this, but they may have some sort of concern. And right now, even how did you find it?
Well, I mean, certainly the fact that these very classified, highly classified, top secret, with a whole bunch of caveats on them, were released is surprising. We see it occur occasionally. I mean, it was about a year and a half ago that was named Tex Aria, the young Air National Guardsman up in Massachusetts, released the deck of slides that were prepared for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff regarding Ukraine. I mean, we see these things from time to time. A lot of times we see them as official leaks, as things the government wants us to know. But very often we don't see the actual documents themselves. So I think for people to see this is what an assessment of our satellite intelligence looks like is probably pretty interesting. You know, I think it doesn't, no one was surprised by what was being said. Certainly there's information in there that people don't know. Supposedly this Golden Horizon missile the Israelis have, no one had mentioned it publicly before. So there's things like that you're going to find in documents like this. But for most part, it's just going to give you some color to the picture, right? It's going to add color to the black and white sketch that we know that the Israelis are preparing to attack Iran. And that one of the ways they're preparing is by rehearsing, and they're loading these air-launched ballistic missiles on their strike aircraft. And in addition to that, they have air refueling tankers. And I mean, so it gives you an idea of what it might look like. And it's a partial glimpse, because certainly the Israelis will do other things in their attack, and how much and in what capacity the Americans will be involved. You can speculate as to, was this leak a ruse? Was it done to misinform the Iranians about how the Israelis will attack? You know what I mean? Like, so you can go down all those pathways in discussing this. The concern over the person who leaked it, or the organization that leaked it, as you were asking, that's a pretty good thing to speculate on. And right now, as of at least last time I saw the news was this morning, so maybe something in the last several hours has been released. But last I saw, really no thoughts or ideas on who released it. By the attitude of the U.S. government, it seems like they don't think it's coming from internally, that it would come externally. So maybe an allied nation that doesn't want to see this happen, or just wants to let the world know that they know this is going on, let the Israelis know, the Americans know that this is going on. Maybe it's, you know, I don't think anyone thinks the Israelis are bluffing. So I don't know what the purpose of releasing this is, just to prove that Israel is preparing to strike Iran. So, you know, understanding, speculating why it was released, I think, you know, in some ways it was done as an act of desperation. That's how I'm kind of looking at it, that whoever did this, whatever individual or institution did this or government did this, it was kind of a wake up call that, look, we are in this stasis right now. We're all walking along. It's as if we're waiting for the next television episode to drop for us to watch. That's not what this is, that we need to wake up, that we're in this march towards a regional war that could prove catastrophic and cataclysmic, and we have to do something about it. I think maybe that's what the purpose of this release was maybe to slap people around, you know, with the reality that, look, they're loading up these air-launched ballistic missiles. This is going to happen, because, you know, I think a lot of us, Nima, are horrified by how we are just waiting. We're just sitting patiently waiting for the Israelis to attack Iran. Why the Iranians haven't struck Israel in a preemptive strike, you know, is another good thing to talk about. I think we can speculate about that. Why the Iranians have held back. I think because the Iranians really do hope that there is an end to this escalation, that the Israelis see some way out by saving face, by launching an attack that's a negligible attack, that doesn't require Iran to respond, that there's some exit ramp off of this still. I think the Iranians still want that, as well as, too, I think the Iranians don't want to give the Americans any excuse whatsoever to join in the attack on Israel in a manner greater than they would do by themselves without further provocation, if you will, from Iran. So maybe those are the reasons why Iran's holding back. But the rest of the world, we're all sitting here very patiently. It's killing us. It's eating us alive. But what else can we do? You know, so we sit patiently and we wait for Israel to attack Iran for what? Then the inevitable Iranian response, which they swear will be something that Israel will feel pain from, that will be a really harsh retaliation for Israel's retaliation. And then what happens then? So the madness, this train that we're strapped on, this car that we're strapped into, and maybe that was the purposes of this, trying to get someone to act. Maybe it's coinciding with the BRICS conference in the sense that perhaps the BRICS, this would force the BRICS nations to maybe act in a manner that would achieve some type of diplomatic entry into this and bring about some type of diplomatic resolution. But I don't know, the speculation. Eventually, I guess we will find out, and it'll be interesting to know, you know, exactly why these things were leaked at the time they were leaked. Yeah.
Yeah. What's so amazing, yesterday we've learned that Sky News, if I'm not mistaken, Arabic Sky News reported that the person who leaked these documents was called Aryan Tabatabai. She's working in Pentagon, Iranian American. They reported this yesterday. Today, Pentagon officially rejected that. No, that's not the case. They're just putting out the fake news. And
yeah. I hadn't even seen that report. Yeah. So yeah.
It was yesterday. We were talking about this. I talked with Scott Ritter on this podcast. And today, Pentagon officially rejected that this news that came out yesterday. But it seems that, Matt, the way you've mentioned what could be the reason behind these documents, but it seems at the end of the day, the United States is not interested. They know that Israel alone is not capable of fighting Iran.
Right.
And they don't want to get involved in a new war in the Middle East. And it could be devastating for everybody, for the world economy, for I cannot imagine how devastating that could be if something big happens.
I think there is an element within the Democratic Party, the Harris campaign, and certainly the Biden White House, that sees an advantage to a limited strike against Iran. That if they could carry off some type of attack on Iran with the Israelis, that would not result in this war that we expect would result, that would be politically beneficial. I mean, for the last several months, the Democrats have been banging on about how the Republicans have been weak on Iran. It's in their platform for the presidential election. The Democratic Party's platform for 2024 speaks as to how the Trump administration was weak on Iran and how Trump should have bombed Iran, but he didn't. So, I mean, there is an element with the Democratic Party that sees a benefit to being tough on Iran by killing a bunch of Iranians. The problem for them, of course, is bridging that, getting that political benefit without launching this major regional war. Certainly I think for the White House and the Harris campaign, the concern about Israel and the United States attacking Iran in a manner that would cause an economic shock that would then cause gasoline in the United States to become $8 a gallon and Harris would lose the election. You know, that concern seems to be waning because we're now less than 2 weeks from the election. I think, hey, if they can delay this attack for another week, then such an economic shock, such an October surprise, at that point you're in November, of the toll at the gas pumps would be something that can be mitigated or can be avoided. And is there a political advantage then in these last 2 weeks of the campaign, knowing you can maybe mitigate these economic gasoline price, whatever shock that might sink a Harris campaign? Is there a political benefit from them from striking Iran and again appearing tough? But I think overall, most level-headed, objective people who essentially have no place in power or position in power, ability to wield power in Washington, D.C., most people will say, yeah, no, a war with Iran is simply not in the United States' interest. They're just the benefits are not there. The risks are so great. We're already overextended. We're already exhausted. We cannot continue to support Ukraine if we go and into this war with Iran, you know, so on and so forth. So all very kind of level-headed, sober reasons why not to engage in a war with Iran, let alone just the consequences of a major regional war in the Middle East. What would that mean? And where would that lead the world to? And what would come next? But the problem is that those people are not in positions of power in the United States. And what we have, a dangerous moment in the U.S. because we have a lame duck president. We have a lame duck secretary of state, lame duck national security advisor. These men will be moving on. They have 2.5 months to burnish their legacy, to seal their reputations, to put their stamp, their imprint on history, as well as to kind of force the hand of whatever administration is coming in next. You're seeing that, I think, this past last several days with Blinken, where his statements really haven't been any different over the last year with regards to Israel. But I get this sense that he's really trying to establish his alibi, establish his excuses, ensure that there's no accountability for him. You know, these past couple of days, Netanyahu assures me that they're not going to ethnically cleanse the north of Gaza, that they're not going to settle Gaza. They assure me this is not the Israeli government policy. And of course, you can see when the Israelis actually do that, at this point, Blinken will be, you know, out the door, or he will be out of the office. And, you know, in his memoirs, he will then write how Netanyahu lied to me. I was taken advantage of. I was trying to be an instrument of peace, and the Israelis lied to me, you know, if he even goes that far. But you kind of see how this administration is setting up their alibis and their excuses and their ability to deflect any type of accountability. At the same time, too, there's this very worrying concern I have that this period, this lame duck period, gives them freedom to do a lot. Once they're past the elections, and once they realize they're not the ones who are going to live with the consequences, does Joe Biden want his legacy to be the man who stood up to the Ayatollahs? For 4 decades, American presidents have avoided direct war with the Ayatollah. They have blood on their hands, these mullahs in Tehran, not just Iranian blood, but American blood. I mean, you hear these comments, you hear Kamala Harris saying this on the campaign trail, how the biggest adversary for the U.S. is Iran. I mean, all this, you know, all the propaganda, all the narrative, all the rhetoric that you would assume would be in place to establish and promote and incite a war is already here. So is this going to be Joe Biden's legacy going out? At least it seems he's focused on Iran in doing that and not on Russia. You know, if October 7th hadn't occurred, possibly in this last year of genocide, possibly we would be facing the same dilemma with, how is Biden going to establish his legacy by, you know, acting tougher against Russia? You know, in this case, it might be against Iran. So, I mean, I think that's the reality of Washington, D.C. as we're seeing it right now.
How did you find the fight between Israelis and Hezbollah so far in the southern part of Lebanon?
It's, I think... As expected, Hezbollah is putting up a very tough fight on the ground. That's to be expected. They prepared for this. Their fighters are inspired by it. They are a continuation of legacy of their fathers and their grandfathers who fought the Israelis for decades. Hezbollah is commanded by men who have real experience in Syria, and they have the bulk of their constituency behind them in a way that even 6 months ago, they may not have had that type of support. I mean, certainly Hezbollah has that support in Lebanon, but I think people understand what I'm saying. When you start bombing and murdering people, they are going to firm up in their resistance, in their loyalty to an organization, to Hezbollah, and their resistance to a country like Israel. So I think we've seen what we expect in terms of Hezbollah on the ground. Israel has been much slower than I think almost everyone expected. They've been stymied, of course, by Hezbollah, but it's also deliberate. And the Israelis are also deliberately advancing in a manner to destroy everything in southern Lebanon that is of use to a society. So they are systematically and deliberately destroying infrastructure. They're destroying schools and mosques and municipal buildings. They are destroying the roads and the bridges. They are doing essentially what they did in Gaza in southern Lebanon, making the land uninhabitable, making the land unlivable. This is sort of an offensive scorched earth policy. And so that also, too, maybe not as predictable, but looking back on it makes total sense. This is what the Israelis are going to do. They have supposedly five divisions on the border. You know, so the military force they have when they are prepared to move in is present. And I think essentially what they want to do is to cleanse southern Lebanon, unofficially annex it, allow eventually maybe some settlers to come in. I think they're more focused on putting settlers in Gaza, of course, but Lebanon is certainly a possibility. If people look at the maps of greater Israel that the Zionists have, Greater Israel on some of these maps extends all the way through Beirut up to Turkey, essentially. So as well as all the way east to the Euphrates River, to Baghdad, right? As well as halfway down the Arabian Peninsula. I mean, so the concept of Greater Israel is massive. But in the more immediate, acute manner, yes, I think they're focused on Gaza, but the idea of settling Lebanon is there, and it will gather steam, it will gather currency, it will gather popularity. I think in the meanwhile, though, what the Israelis want to do is to push the population out and essentially create a free fire zone within southern Lebanon, a kill anything that moves south of the Litani River. So again, very similar to what they're doing in Gaza. I don't know how this actually gets the Israeli citizens, Israeli settlers of northern Israel back into their homes, as is the stated goal of this Israeli operation. But it's simply because the Hezbollah rockets are longer ranged than the distance between the Litani River and northern Israel. So they could, you know, ostensibly to stop that, you'd have to push all the way through up to northern Israel to stop those rockets and missiles and drones from being fired. But again, as we've discussed before, Nima, this is not a war about actually winning anything. You know, there's territory involved. There certainly is the purpose of destroying an adversarial military power. That is all there. But really, this is so much about just punishment for the sake of punishment sense, right? This idea that the Dahiya doctrine of that civilian casualties in and of themselves are a war aim. So you have that. So you're just punishing these people because they deserve it, because this is what you do to those who stand up against you, particularly when you have a supremacist mindset. This is what you have to do to the other. This is what you have to do to the subhumans. This is, you have to put them in their place, essentially. And the other aspect of this, of course, is the political. The fact that this war, whether it's Gaza, whether it's the West Bank, whether it's Lebanon, whether it's with Iran, Yemen, et cetera, has been politically beneficial to Netanyahu's governing coalition. So as long as this war continues to go on, the political benefits will follow for him. That's their assumption. That's their belief. The other aspects too, right? I mean, Naftali Bennett probably said it the clearest. It's been said by other Israelis, but most recently Bennett said just 2 weeks ago, this is a once in a 50-year opportunity. So whether you are on the secular side of this for the Israelis or the religious side, so whether you're a militarist, a nationalist, or a theocratic Zionist, the idea is like, this is our opportunity. This is our chance to either get our buffer zone, to get more territory, to fulfill our obligation to history, to see the culmination of our Zionist plan. I mean, on and on and on, you see how there is no desire, there's no need for this to end in war for itself. Now, of course, it's madness. Can the Israelis sustain this? How long can they continue this for? The whole plan is predicated on continual support and massive support from the United States, which, of course, I assume I bet anything they're going to continue to get for years to come. But I mean, you look at this and you just, you just the horror of it. I mean, we saw that the horror of the genocide is one thing, but then the horror of this war for the sake of war, the sake of fulfilling a Zionist historical narrative and to put it into place and to make it real, you know, that's a separate horror that who knows what will bring. And this is a thing we've been fearful of for as we've discussed many, many times now.
What, in your opinion, what was the reason behind this drone attack on Netanyahu's house?
Go ahead. I think it was probably to send a signal, like many people have said, that we can get you or we will try and get you, that don't think you're off limits. You know, maybe they thought they'd get lucky and he was home for the weekend or something like that, you know. But the fact that they put the drone into his bedroom window is impressive. And that says a lot. The fact that the Israelis published that and verified it also says a lot. So when I first heard about the drone actually hitting his bedroom window, I thought, well, okay, that's one thing. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. Who knows? But then the Israelis themselves were the ones who released that and said, look, and they showed it. Here's a picture of the bedroom window and everything else. And so you can see how both sides, their propaganda and their actions to support their propaganda is geared to their own constituents, is geared to their own public, to their supporters. So even when you have something like the Hezbollah hits the prime minister's beach home and hits his bedroom. And normally, you know, you don't confirm what's called BDA, battle damage assessment. You never confirm that for the enemy. You just don't do it. In this case, the Israelis are happy to do it because the image of Hezbollah striking Netanyahu's home, that's meant to incite, that's meant to arouse, that's meant to solidify Israeli public opinion. And Israeli public opinion, just like it was for Gaza, just like it was for, you know, what they're doing in the West Bank, is very strong and supportive of this war in Lebanon. I mean, incredibly popular thing to do is to kill Hassan Nasrallah, excuse me. I mean, incredibly popular. The joy and the jubilance and the excitement in Israel over that, right? I mean, so you flip that in the head, and so you're not now showing your success. You're showing the danger of Hezbollah, the danger of the other. And of course, you link this to Iran. Yeah, and you see the propaganda benefits of showing a successful strike by Hezbollah on your prime minister's weekend home. And of course, the Americans take that and they run with it. And now hear anything from the White House, from members of Congress and the American media, it's about how the Iranians tried to assassinate Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, whether the Iranians had anything to do with it, I doubt it. Who knows? But Hezbollah did this. You know, and it's almost as if in America, the disconnect between, yeah, but the Israelis have been assassinating people over and over again. They assassinated Nasrallah, assassinated the entire Hezbollah command. They assassinated Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran. I mean, like they struck the Iranian diplomatic mission in Syria. I mean, like all these affronts to international law. This claim that this crime of trying to assassinate Netanyahu, it's a casus belli, right? It's a reason for war. So the Israelis are very adept at using these types of things for their own purposes, particularly telling their people or telling the Americans what they need to know in order to continue their support. It's also interesting, too, that this strike on Netanyahu's house in the American media, many ways covered up or at least obscured for a bit the conversation about Yahya Sinwar's death, right? So the conversation about Sinwar's death and what Sinwar meant and who he was, and you know, the particularly that the iconic, the legendary imagery now of him in his final moments, that gets suppressed because now we're talking about how the Iranians tried to kill Netanyahu in his vacation home or his weekend home or whatever that place in Caesarea was. So yeah, I mean, like even something like that, you can see really how the dimensions, the dynamics of it extend well past what, you know, something other than was a pretty good attack by Hezbollah, even if it was just a symbolic attack.
In your opinion, why they have decided, Israelis decided to put out that footage about the Yahya Sinwar?
I don't know.
Did they really think that it's going to humiliate the Gazans?
I don't know. I think, I mean, obviously it was meant internally for the Israelis to show that we did kill this man. Here's his last moments. They thought it was somehow humiliating, that maybe they thought maybe they're so, as Senator William Fulbright said, right, the power mistakes itself for virtue. Maybe they thought that their drones, their technology, their power is virtuous, and that this shows their supremacy over the Palestinians. Here's this dirty old man, all beaten up, half blown up, half dead, in a dusty, disgusting chair that's been, you know, bombed out. And here's our drone. Maybe that was like the type of calculation. Maybe it was a proof of life type of thing. Like, here he really is, in this sense, a proof of death, you know, that we really did get him. But certainly whatever benefits it provided to the Israeli public, and they certainly met this with great celebration, and they were in the streets, and they were celebrating in bars and popping bottles of champagne and so forth, reminiscent of when the United States killed Osama bin Laden in 2011 and the celebrations here. And then, of course, what comes on after bin Laden's death, you know, the greatest successes of Al-Qaeda, you know, in Syria, in Libya, in other places. But the, you know, I mean, the calculate, whatever that was, whatever benefit they got from their own people by showing this video is trumped by many degrees with the effect this video has had on not just Palestinians, but on the international community. I mean, they have basically, for those who might have thought positively of Sinwar as a leader of the resistance, or who thought maybe neutrally as a man who was doing what he needed to do, and I don't like his methods and so on and so forth, regardless of your perspective, whether you're neutral towards him or just mildly positive towards him, you have now been moved into the ranks of those who say, wow, look at that. Look at this defiance. Look at this man who is half dead, who is still fighting to the end, who throws that piece of wood at the drone, and the drone runs away. You know, I mean, like, look at that defiance. This is a true leader. This is a man who went to the end for his people. You know what I mean? So that legend, the icon, the mythology that is now being created for Sinwar, where it may not have existed before, and simply because of this video. If they just announced they had killed him and that was it, okay, people would have said, okay, this is one of the leaders of the Palestinian resistance. He was the Hamas leader. You can debate about, is he a terrorist? Is he a freedom fighter? But now with this video, right, with this imagery of him, this mythological type action of his at the end, that defiance, people around the world are rallying to that. And as I've said otherwise, how long until we see that image on a t-shirt? I'm sure it's already there. I'm sure people already have it. So the mistake by Israel in releasing that video, I mean, this is a pivotal moment. This is historic. This is a defining moment for not just Palestinian resistance, for resistance around the world. You know, BRICS is going on right now, or just ended today, or whatever. You 22 heads of states there, big, big deal. You don't think these guys talked about that? You know, you don't think Z said to Modi, did you see that video of Sinwar? You know, I mean, this has that effect even at that level. Mm-hmm. But among just the people of this world who look at Israel and by extension the American empire, they see in Sinwar what people 5 decades ago saw in Che Guevara, right? And so like Che, Sinwar will have that place in the world for decades to come, I think.
Yeah. We remember what has happened to the Al-Shifa hospital in those days. Israelis put out a video showing that underneath the hospital there are various tunnels, and Hamas is there, and they destroyed the hospital. Right now, they're trying to do the same in Lebanon with Al-Hariri, if I'm not mistaken, hospital. We had the U.S. envoy Hochstein going to Lebanon, talking with military and with policymakers in Lebanon. In your opinion, what's going on right now between the Biden administration and the Lebanese officials? And what they're talking about, in your opinion? Because if they try to do the same as they did in Gaza, it would be, do you think that these people in Lebanon are talking about this with the Biden administration?
I think there are some factions in Lebanon certainly talking to the Biden administration who see that there is possibility for them, that there's opportunity here. I mean, certainly Lebanon, as everyone knows, is a divided country. There's factions. It's fractious. You know, Hezbollah is one part of the country, so to say. I mean, it's certainly not to diminish Hezbollah's role and their role in the parliament and their role as a real political power. But there are other actors in Lebanon, as we've known. I mean, go back and read about the Lebanese civil war. So I think what you see, particularly say with Hochstein, the Americans coming in and trying to divide and conquer, the Americans coming in trying to engineer greater dissension, trying to really cause those cracks to break wide open, to try and, if you cannot divorce Hezbollah, I mean, if you cannot divorce the Lebanese Shia from Hezbollah, well, then maybe you can divorce the Lebanese Shia from Lebanon. Right. So this idea, and you've seen that with Hochstein's comments when he was in Beirut the other day, essentially stating this is all Hezbollah's fault, that the future of Lebanon should never have been tied to entrance into a war that doesn't concern you. You know, basically saying Hezbollah is the one who's brought all this onto you, and that your destruction in Beirut, it's not the fault of the Israelis and their 2,000-pound American bombs. It's the fault of Hezbollah who brought this on to you. And there are enough actors within Lebanon who see opportunity in that. And so if the Americans can engineer in Lebanon what they engineered in Iraq, they will go and do so. Because for the Americans, for someone like Hochstein or for Brett McGurk, who was very involved in Iraq, one of the most key players in Iraq. I knew McGurk in 2004 when we were in Iraq together. These people, these men, Nima, they understand that was a catastrophe. I mean, they've got the window dressing. They've got their ability to lie about it and to try and euphemize what happened there and to stutter around it and to apologize for it and to make it seem as something it was not. But they understand, I think, that it was a failure. It was a catastrophe. It was a fiasco. But they think they can do it better this time. You know, I years ago, I was on a television show with Brett McGurk, and he was convinced, and this is with regards to the escalation of the Afghan war, McGurk was convinced that even though Iraq was a disaster, even though that, you know, things did not go well there and that we were getting out of Iraq and, you know, but doing the same thing in Afghanistan was going to work because we had learned our lessons. And I think that's what they really think. These people really do believe, first and foremost, in their own abilities, and certainly in their own purposes, and certainly even more so in their own interests, what's best for them. So their cynical calculations come back to this idea that they can manipulate things. And you saw this, right? We talked about this, about both Hochstein and McGurk, that Politico piece from 2-3 weeks ago, maybe longer at this point, where Politico, explains how American officials, Hochstein and McGurk, had said to the Israelis, look, we are saying that we want a ceasefire in Lebanon. We're saying this publicly, but we're telling you directly that we think it's in the best interest of the region for you to invade Lebanon. So potentially giving the go-ahead to Israel to invade Lebanon. These are people who not only have no problem lying, as they lied to the Lebanese, as they lied to the world about this, but they also think that an Israeli invasion of Lebanon would make the Middle East a better place. They really do believe this. So this is what you're up against. And so when you see someone like Hochstein fly in and he makes these comments and he has all these meetings, well, I'm sure there are Lebanese who rebuffed him and who don't want to go along, who see the tragedy that awaits them, like a Shakespearean tragedy that awaits them if they align with him and they go forward with his plan and they think they can carry out these Machiavellian maneuvers and that, you know, at this time, the Lebanese civil war will go well. You know, this is essentially what's there. But there are people who see opportunity in that. And this is why, just as with the Palestinians, your heart breaks for the Palestinians, because there is no hope for the Palestinians. They have nothing. There are no political players for them. You know, I got asked about this the other day about, you know, when we talk about this, the Palestinians are an afterthought in terms of how it ends, because they have no ability to project any power. All they can do is resist, and they should continue to resist. It's the right thing to do. It's the legally right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do, the historically correct thing to do. And God help them and God bless them. But there is, as I see, no hope for the Palestinians. As long as the United States backs Israel the way it does, the Palestinians, unfortunately, unless there is some type of deus ex machina, something that comes from the outside that we can't predict or see, they are going to suffer. It's just a question of what their suffering looks like. And the Lebanese, to a degree, as well. The Lebanese, to a degree, they have, I think, greater power, greater Hezbollah, you know, in terms of Lebanon itself. But Lebanon is a weak, fractured country. And so its ability to go forward in a cohesive, strong manner that would set its own conditions, that would allow for its own agency, that would allow for its a future dictated by itself, is simply not there. And so Lebanon, a lot more complicated than Palestine, a lot more complicated than Gaza, say, but you could see the same pathway where Lebanon is going to suffer as the Israelis and the Americans want them to suffer until they decide to end it. Again, unless there's some external actor that comes in that we're not seeing. And we're not seeing that right now. There's no one who's going to come in. And the way out of it then, at best, is that this war breaks out between the wars already broken out. But I think people understand what I mean, in a sense of that this regional war occurs where the cost is so great to Israel because 100,000 missiles are dropped on their heads that they back off. If people think that that's the pathway to seeing an end to this, to seeing some type of realization of stability or, God help us, justice, it's not going to happen. Better chance that that does happen. 100,000 missiles are fired onto Israel and Israel responds with nuclear weapons. I mean, the pathways here, Nima, are worse and worse and worse. And this is why something like BRICS is so important. Because there are no international institutions, there are no alliances or relationships in the world that can stand up to the United States empire, the American empire, as it exists right now. And the American empire is declining and it is being isolated. It is falling apart. It is causing its own death. But something like BRICS, some type of international organization outside of the UN, because the UN is ultimately feckless because of the United States, is that the possibility for some type of action to stop this? But it's not present right now. And so 5-10 years from now, so when you go back to this idea, like, as I, you know, I think I said just to you before about Naftali Bennett saying this is a once in 50 year opportunity, it is, in the sense of, like, yes, we have our chance now to go ahead and do all these things. October 7th gave us this opportunity. The Americans are full bore with us, et cetera, et cetera. But it also have to look at, in a sense, there's no opposition. There's nothing's going to stop us right now. 5 or 10 years from now, there may be an organization like BRICS. You know, BRICS is not supposed to be military security, but certainly the issue of Palestine was addressed in Kazan, in Russia, at the BRICS meeting. So 5 or 10 years from now, would it be possible for such a thing to be being carried out by Israel, this seven front war of theirs? Maybe not. But the reality we're dealing with right now is that, you know, unfortunately, the Palestinians will suffer as the Israelis and the Americans want them to suffer until the Israelis and Americans decide that it's enough. And to a degree, the Lebanese await the same fate. At least southern Lebanon awaits the same fate. The Israelis will encounter tremendous resistance in Lebanon, as they have been. I think you'll see greater weapons being supplied to Hezbollah that had previously not been supplied to Hezbollah. Ultimately, this is, you know, right here at the end of October 2024. That's the way I see it. Hopefully what I'm seeing doesn't last for very long, but I think that's the case.
What's so amazing for me about Hochstein, and if I were to send somebody to Lebanon, Hoxton would be the last person to think of because he has served in the IDF.
Right.
You have no respect for the people that you're trying to talk with.
Right. Right. And his statements and everything he's done in his life, there's not like, it's not like, yeah, he was a kid, he joined the IDF, and now he's a 50-year-old man or so, and he has moved on to other things in his life, and that was 30-some-odd years ago, and okay, so be it. You know, he was in the IDF, but he's a pretty honest broker now. You've seen that based on his other experiences. There's nothing in the last 30 years of this man's life that make you think he'd be an honest broker, that he'd be in any way objective or fair or have anything other than his own personal and institutional agendas that he's pushing, as well as this loyalty to Israel, which is still there. You've seen this, though, throughout for the Americans throughout for decades. I mean, the American ambassadors, of course, the ambassadors are going to be biased, but any of the American negotiators, these Middle East representatives, these special envoys, they have always been in league with Israel. They have always been in Israel's camp. They would never get to that position of being special envoy or negotiator or representative or whatever without being vetted by Israel. And so you have this farce put on by the Americans in our, one farcical aspect of the whole farcical reality of American diplomacy, which barely actually exists other than just perpetuating, right, this type of propaganda, this farce, if I can just keep using that word, because I don't know what the better word for it, that somehow that the Americans are coming in and going to be an honest broker, that they're going to come in and negotiate, that they're going to come in and try and achieve something for all players involved to benefit from, when no, the whole purpose is to benefit the United States. And in this case, in the Middle East, it's always to benefit Israel. It's the way it has been, and the way until something changes, until we get this legalized bribery system out of control of the United States, until our political system is no longer legalized bribery, that's the way it will be. And that's why this support for Israel goes on, indefinitely. I don't see an end to it. And I hope to God I'm wrong, but I don't see an end to it for years and years, decades to come, maybe.
And when we look at BRICS right now, and you look at the people, the presidents who were there in this summit, Maduro from Venezuela, Azerbaijan, Belarus, Turkey, right now they're talking about, we are concerned about Turkey right now. They're talking about it for more than 6 months, 1 year, they're talking about it. And right now in the West, they're talking, now we're concerned about Turkey right now. How, and yesterday, I don't know if you look at the mainstream media, CNN, ABC, Time, all of them were surprised. Why is Russia not isolated? Why there are so many leaders there talking with?
It seems yeah, like
we are not living on the same planet.
I saw a bit of that. These questioning articles, like these ponderous articles, wondering why, what there must be something else going on, or what's happening here, or why, how are the Russians bribing these nations? And, it's got to be because they can get cut rate Russian oil. That's got to be the only answer to this, because they're buying the Russian oil below market prices, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Or that they're all autocrats and they admire each other. So Erdogan is an autocrat and he admires Putin. I mean, these are the explanations they're given. Other than the actual real explanation is that the United States' actions, the empire's actions over these decades, but especially these last several years, have pushed all these nations together. The idea that you have this relationship between Iran and Russia and China, which didn't exist before. Everyone is all hot and bothered right now because the North Koreans are supposedly putting troops into Russia. I don't know. Who knows? But regardless of whether it could be because Putin and Russia and North Korea signed a mutual defense agreement back in the summer. Why did they sign a mutual defense agreement now? They've been neighbors forever, right? I mean, why now is there this mutual defense agreement between Russia and North Korea? What pushed them to this point. And the same with the Chinese and the Russians and the Iranians. Ryan Grimm of Drop Site News published it, but I'd seen it before. The great Scott Horton of Anti-War Radio talks about it all the time. But Grimm published the video from 1997 of Joe Biden speaking about NATO expansion. And he obviously had been asked about, well, the Russians aren't happy about this. And his Biden's response in 97 about the Russians not being happy about NATO expansion was like, what are they going to do about it? And then he says, what are they going to do? Ally with the Chinese? Go ahead. Better yet, go ahead and ally themselves with the Iranians. You know, this is, I'm glad that Grimm published it. I'm glad people are seeing it. It's something that Scott Horton brings up all the time. And it's just right there in front of us. We created this. We made this reality, you know, this alliance that's against, and this is how it's now going to be framed, right? It's going to be us versus them. So the idea of a unipolar world is ending. We're going back to what we describe in the West as a bipolar world, which is not at all what the BRICS countries want. If you look at what BRICS is trying to do, they're trying to create a multipolar world where there are not these alliances, where there are not people put out, where there are not nations propped against each other, but rather one of coordination and community. You know, I mean, that's a bit pie in the sky and romantic, but I believe the amount of money that can be made off of that and the development that can come from that is pushing that real that desire of theirs. So there's a practical benefit to it, not just a romantic ideological, you know, vision. But, you know, the reality of how it will be discussed in the West, how it will be discussed, you know, within the purview of the American empire, particularly in American media and American political circles, will be us versus them. That we are up against, you know, these people have allied against us. Why do they ally against us? Well, because they don't like us. And now we get back to, you know, they hate us for our freedoms, those types of things. Yeah.
Yeah. Just to wrap up this session, it's so amazing when they're talking about Turkey. As we talk, there is a terrorist attack in Turkey right now. It's a Kurdish type of, I don't know these groups, Kurdish groups that we know that, Matt, the United States is helping the Kurdish people against Turkey, which is part of NATO. And they, the United States and Turkey are part of NATO, but the United States is supporting the Kurdish people against. It's unbelievable, as you've mentioned. It's the same kind of policy. They're just going on and they're doing the same. They don't think that. I don't know if they're still thinking that they can continue with this type of behavior. Is arrogance, hubris? What's the mindset? Are they, because at the end of the day, we are seeing BRICS just reshaping the world before our eyes right now.
It's an imperial mindset, Nima. And so it's the idea that, one, the empire can't lose. The empire can't lose anything at all, ever. It's as simple as that. And the other is that you have to use the imperial stratagems, going back to Julius Caesar, you know, before that, actually, divide and conquer, right? So you utilize the Kurds. I mean, the Kurdish example is so tragic and it's so horrific. The earliest I know that the United States government starts arming the Kurds, and I may be off, and somebody please tell me in the comments, but is in 1973, which is the year I was born, that Nixon and Kissinger start arming the Kurds. And then at some point, several years later, particularly after Saddam takes power, they drop the Kurds, right? And then there's this relationship between the U.S. and the Kurds where we're helping them, and then when we're throwing them under the bus, you know, over and over and over again. Also, too, but you've seen this dynamic appear where for decades, this was the case, you know, with as you said, with Turkey and with Iraq, where in Iraq, we are supporting the Kurdish against the Iraqi government, while then saying that the Kurds across the border are PKK terrorists. And, you know, I mean, because they, I mean, like the whole thing is just, it's convoluted. It makes no sense. And anyone who would look at this would say, this is bound to blow up. This is bound to be but now, of course, the Kurds are important again because the Kurds can be used against the Iranians. You know, I mean, just as the Kurds could be used against Assad. And then was when, then when we realized that, well, the Syria thing's not working so well, we're going to bail out of Syria, we're going to abandon the Kurds again. And so the Kurds are just a tragic story over and over again of what the imperial mindset really is that sometimes you matter to us and other times you don't. Sometimes you're on our good side, other times you're on your bad side. It all depends upon what our calculations that day are of what our benefit to us. And this is what informs all these nations to want to join BRICS, to find something that they should have found in the United Nations, but that's been corrupted for decades. I don't even know at this point, really looking back fairly, did it ever have a chance? But the other thing then is that, you know, we got to find something, we got to build something. So all these nations are lining up to join BRICS because it is an alternative. And they see not just the economic benefits, you know, getting away from this American monetary and financial and economic world order, which is extractive, to put it simply, but also too a way to protect themselves. Because at what point do you start getting treated like the Kurds? At what point do you start getting treated like any nation? At what point does Amos Hochstein show up in your country and try to start manufacturing another civil war? Right. I mean, like it's happened over and over and over again. This is the modus operandi for the American empire, probably is for all empires. And until you join some type of counter, some type of protective alliance, whether it's alliance, in actual name or just informally, you are at risk. You are at the mercy of the empire. You are in danger. And so we're only going to see this continue to develop because you're not going to see an American change in policy in the Middle East. At best, you might see something happen with regards to Eastern Europe if a Trump administration comes in. But I don't know if I buy that. I mean, we'll wait and see what happens. But I'm not believing anything Trump's saying about this. You know, it could get worse for all we know there. But say, give him the benefit of the doubt. Say he does end that war like he says he will. You know, the reasons for the Republicans' disdain or dislike for the Ukraine war is because the $185 billion we spent on Ukraine killing Russians, they Republicans feel we should have used that money killing Chinese. So, I mean, like the pathways here, the avenues again, are worse and worse and worse. And there seems to be no exit off of this machine that we are strapped onto. And of course, the one that we're waiting for right now, as I said before, is this Israeli strike on Iran, and we're just waiting for this machine to make its next gear movement, and we can't do anything. We're in stasis. And so you see these other nations doing something to try and protect themselves as well as deliver themselves benefits, because being under this economic order of the United States is not beneficial to them. If this was a television show we were watching, it'd be fantastic. It'd be so exciting. It'd be, wow, what great writers. You know, this is really interesting. But what we're observing is something that's incredibly dangerous and most likely, is going to get worse. And hopefully it doesn't.
We know you talk about Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. We know that there are other candidates who are much more capable of bringing some sort of sanity to the foreign policy, to the domestic policy of the United States. And when we talk about a third option for the people to vote for, who comes to your mind?
Well, thanks for setting it up that way. Yeah, I'm a Jill Stein supporter. I'm a Green Party supporter in the United States. In general, I'm an independent politics third party supporter in general. So if Jill Stein, who I'm in line with her platform, I respect her greatly. I admire her. She's got my vote. But if for some reason she wasn't on the ballot here in North Carolina, I would vote for another independent candidate, most likely Cornel West, because West, it meets my political and philosophical, we're similar. I should say I'm similar to him. I don't want to equate him to me. But if that wasn't the case, then I would vote for Chase Oliver, who's a libertarian. The idea being is that we have to build independent political power, and we are up against a Leviathan. We are up against the internal empire, if you will, this duopoly, a unip- party, if you want to call it that, that is just one giant corporate party that then has degrees of differences on some issues and real differences on societal and cultural issues that are important, but in the larger extent don't matter to the corporations. And so that's what we're up against. We're up against this establishment, this system that has to change. And electoral politics is one way to do it, putting pressure electorally, politically. It does work. It's difficult. It's hard. Again, we're up against Leviathan, but it also cannot only be taken as the sole way itself, that it has to be considered as an entire body, and that the electoral, the political aspect is just one arm. But if you don't have that political arm, then nothing is possible. And what I point to, as I point to, and many others point to this as well, is the post-George Floyd Black Lives Matter movement in the summer of 2020, where we had 20, 25 million people out on the streets of the United States. And what political change came from that? Nothing, or near nothing. You know, so if you don't have a political apparatus that can respond to the pressures that society puts onto the political machine, then nothing is possible at all. I mean, so that's my view of why you need to build independent power. It's Sisyphean. It's difficult. It may well prove impossible, but it has to be done. It has to be done. Otherwise, you're ceding that space to the duopoly, to the Democrats and Republicans, to the corporations without offering a fight. And just like anything else, whether it's we're opposing the empire and its actions overseas, or we're imposing it here at home, at the very least, we go down swinging. And that's what matters. That's what matters. I mean, that there's no other alternative than that.
Thank you so much, Matt, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
All right. Thank you, Nima. I appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone watching and listening.